Welcome to the Georgetown Public Policy Review Podcast. My name is Mike Saunders. I'm an MPM student here at the McCord School of Public Policy. My guest today is Mr. Melvin Foote of the Constituency for Africa, a nonprofit organization dedicated to building organized support for Africa in the United States, as well as connecting the global African diaspora to cultural, business, and educational opportunities on the Africa. I talk with Mr. Foote about his successes and challenges working with multiple presidential administrations, how media representation and perception can make his job easier or harder, and why he believes that the next step in the global movement for African diaspora connection is going to be primarily a youth-driven movement. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. Thanks for listening. Hey, Mr. Foote, how are you today?
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
All right. Perfect. So the way it works at GPPR is our intro is actually going to get recorded after the fact. I'll just sort of summarize what we talked about. So we can jump right in if you're ready.
That's fine.
So today we've got Mr. Melvin Foote with us. He's the president of the Constituency for Africa. I first met Mr. Foote when he gave a wonderful discussion at the Africa Policy Students Association. And I remember when I reached out to you to sort of schedule this interview, you mentioned that you were going on a very, or you had just returned from rather, a very, very intense trip to Ghana. Do you mind telling me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a trip to Mali, to Bamako, and I just got back about 2 weeks ago. It was a trade mission, and of course, Mali is one of the countries in the Sahel that have experienced a coup d'etat in recent years, and the U.S. has a tense relationship with the Sahel. Part of it was these countries in the Sahel were colonized by France, and they were brutally colonized. And even to this day, France has been ripping these countries off, you know, taking their natural resources, giving them very little development in the country. And so these countries, Mali, Niger, Chad, Burkina Faso, now Gabon, these countries have got fed up with the French. And they basically said the young people are saying no more. So the U.S. Response seemed to be more in line with supporting their French ally as opposed to supporting the people of the Sahel. And so that's really where we are. So the U.S. has taken a hard line. Whenever they do these things, they come up with a policy directive. Basically, we're going to withdraw all U.S. aid. We're going to withdraw U.S. military support. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And it comes across as lecturing and that kind of thing. And these countries are no longer responding to that either. So when this trip came up, I was asked to go. I have a Malian friend who runs a diaspora association of Malians up in Philadelphia. She's based in Philadelphia. She's been coming to CFA's activities for the last several years. She comes to some of our meetings here in Washington. She said, look, I want to put together a trade mission to Mali. All that the U.S. government is saying about Mali is wrong. It's not insecure. Terrorists are not taking over everything. Sure, they got a Russian presence and, you know, they kicked out the French and accepted the Russians' security in the north. There's a lot of issues. But the Malian people, by and large, don't hate America. They love America. And they want America to be engaged, but they want us to be engaged in a pragmatic and realistic fashion. So that's really the situation that I went to Mali on. You know, I got there, I didn't know really what the, it was a delegation of about 12 people, and I was heading the delegation. And so I didn't know fully, I'd been to Mali once before, about maybe 12, 15 years ago. You know, I enjoyed it back then. You know, Malian people are very nice. You know, the first thing that hits you is that they're very nice people. They're very culturally dynamic. Their music is great. You know, there's nothing not to like about Bamako. Now, the security challenges are in the north. And part of that is because when the U.S. pulled out of the war on terror in the Middle East, we actually took out Muammar Gaddafi. Everybody knows it. And we took him out, but we did not secure the weapons. He had a major military force, and those weapons fell in the hands of terrorists. And the terrorists were not going to attack the U.S. in Baghdad or Syria. They weren't going to fight the U.S. there, but they ended up taking those weapons south across the Sahara and wreaked hell upon these countries. So the U.S., you know, refused to help, and yet we created the problem in the first place, right? So that's where we are today. So I went, I found the country was fantastic. It was a fantastic visit. We were hosted by the U.S. ambassador there, who's a friend. You know, I'd known her for a long time since she got out there. We met with the prime minister of Mali. You know, we had dinner with the prime minister, and we met with all kinds of entrepreneurs who want to do business in America. They want American help in a lot of different areas, agriculture, tourism, you know, technology. They want all kinds of things that the U.S. could be doing business with. But we got this political directive coming from our State Department that scares people off. You know, you don't even want to go because you're scared. How many people told me before going, oh, be careful. Oh, this, that, and the other. I told them out there the only security challenge I seen was that they have these motorcycles all over the place, these motorbikes. That's how you get around in Mali. And you know, they're kind of like taxis and all that. Zillion of them going zoop, zoop, zoop. That's the only security challenge I've seen in the country. And so we did a report. I certainly got it to the State Department, the White House, all of the political apparatus. And we actually are changing the policy. We're seeing signs, even though somebody told me today, they looked at the website, and now they're talking about people-to-people dialogue. That's what we advocated. So I'm happy about that. But the U.S. must change its attitude toward Africa if we are to have a relationship with Africa that we all want.
You took this trip to Mali, and I wanted to really highlight something that I found really interesting in the press release you put out. Some of the ministries that you had met with and interfaced with when you arrived: agriculture, trade and commerce, youth and sports, education, women, family, and children. Now, my immediate thought was, this was not an accident. These were very, very intentional sort of delegations that you wanted to meet with. So tell me a little bit about the rhyme and reason that that it was these ministries in particular.
Well, the delegation were put together by two different sources. One is, her name is Mama Traore, and she's like they're based in Philadelphia, but she's 8 months pregnant, right? She's 8 months pregnant, so she couldn't travel, actually. So she called me up. She wanted me to identify some people in my network who could go, you know? So I would say half of the people were people that she selected as she went about recruiting for the trade mission, and the other half were people that I provided. So it was quite interesting. It was 12 people. 11 of them were Black. One was a white guy. Half of them were Malians, you know, in the diaspora. But there also was a Nigerian who came over from a Nigeria who she had met in, you know, in another conference, and she invited him to come over. We had one Black woman from London, you know, who runs an environmental sanitation project. I invited a good friend of mine who's a Ugandan who lives in Ottawa, Canada, and she heads up the Canadian Africa Trade Desk. She was great. So it was African-American, African immigrant. We had the one white guy who, you know, was Mama's, you know, he was very skilled in Africa and trade and that kind of thing. But it was by and large an African diaspora delegation.
Interesting, interesting. You know, sort of one thing that I've noticed that I also noticed when looking at the Constituency for Africa website, and, you know, and even listening to the talk that you had given, you place a very, very high emphasis on the youth. One theme that one could hear throughout your talks was that the youth need to step up, you emphasize how young a continent that Africa is in general, and how much opportunity is present in this. Can you tell me a little bit about your stance on youth and sort of where you see things going? What sort of investment do you see?
Well, we had one young guy who's a Liberian American who works with the Africa Town Project in Philadelphia. It's a multi-million dollar effort that's underway to establish Africa Town in Philadelphia. And he's one of the officers working on it. Now, I would say he's in his 20s, you know, maybe late 20s, hip hop, all that. But, you know, the guy, that's my first time really meeting him. I had met him at some of the forums up in Philadelphia, but I never really sat down with him and, you know, spent time with him. But this guy was dynamic, you know, very dynamic, very next generation. Everything he talked about was really, you know, it's the future, not the past. And one night I was asked to come down. I had a package. Somebody had sent a package to me. So the front desk called me and said, you got a package here. So I went downstairs to get my package, and I heard music coming out of the bar. So I stuck my head into the bar. He was up there on the stage rapping, you know. And the guy was good, you know. He was a rapper. The guy was good. So it was kind of like a mind-boggling. But when you looked at the composition of it, you really saw the whole spectrum. And, you know, he clearly had things to say in the conference, but he was respectful of his elders and all that. But he had, you know, there's several times I paused to ask him a question or to get his perspective. The thing that really strikes me, a couple of days ago, I was over at Howard University at a graduate class, International Affairs and African Affairs, and Ambassador Johnny Carson was the featured speaker. I spoke over there last month. I was the featured speaker. So I went back, and it was great. You know, now these are graduate students, and they were happy that I came after giving my speech, and they knew I went to Mali. So there was a lot of excitement about that. But at the same time, you clearly see that we're talking now. They see me as a mentor, someone who they can really ask questions. Many of them, you know, wanted to set up a time that I could really either meet with them separately or to talk about the things that they want to do and just to get my opinion about stuff. And I'm, you know, I feel good about that. I think that's really where I need to spend more of my time as I start to wind down my career. I need to spend more of my time with those who are stepping up, you know?
I definitely agree with that. I definitely agree. And I definitely understand your perspective on that. Now, one other thing that I find very interesting about you, about your organization, you used the word earlier, pragmatic. You're not somebody who I perceived as taking an inherently hostile posture as in terms of interacting or interfacing with the U.S. in general, but you are somebody who's you're not afraid to call out what you see as bad actions, as bad policy. You're not afraid to point out when something when the natures of certain relationships are unproductive. Tell me a little bit about you know, sort of what drives that pragmatic stance into attracting investment and, you know, sort of improving the condition in Africa. And especially tell me about the Ronald H. Brown African Affairs series. I believe that happens with the Congressional Black Caucus. Again, just another example of interfacing with official channels and doing these in a straightforward and matter-of-fact fashion.
Yeah, well, the reality is I've been working on Africa for over 50 years now, you know, and you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody else who could tell you that, you know. You know, so I started out as a 22-year-old Peace Corps volunteer, and I've been working on Africa ever since, right? And I worked at various levels in Africa, Peace Corps at the community level. I worked with AFRICARE for many years, directing their constituency development program, which evolved into CFA. So one way or another, I've been working on Africa all these years. I work with all kinds of administrations. I work with George W. Bush. I work with Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. I tried to work with Trump even. You know, they asked me for some things and they didn't fulfill them, but I tried. I mean, I'm not partisan. It ain't like I'm trying to pick sides or whatever. Both sides need to do better. I've also, you know, my work itself evolved. When I came to Washington in 84, there were several Black organizations that were major that were working on Africa. AFRICARE was a big kahuna, the organization I work with that does rural development in Africa. They built wealth. Most of the AFRICARE staff were former Peace Corps volunteers, and so they know practically how to improve the quality of life in Africa. But there was also TransAfrica, which Randall Robinson. TransAfrica was the lobby organization that got Nelson Mandela free from prison. Wow. They were very much working on U.S. policy. They were more left sort of leaning than right leaning. But their whole mission was to get the Congressional Black Caucus and others to press for political change in U.S. policy toward Africa. Leon Sullivan, you know, who came up with the Sullivan Principles as a way of for Americans to engage in South Africa. Sullivan was a absolutely dynamic force. He was a pastor. He was a corporate person. He had a tremendous charisma and very dynamic. Now, none of these types of people exist today. None of these types of organizations exist today. So all of the Black organizations, you had the National Council of Negro Women with Dorothy Height. You had Africa Action. You had Washington Office on Africa. All of these groups, none of these groups exist today. The only one that exists remaining is CFA. And so you ask yourself why. Now, these organizations were multi-million dollar in stature. AFRICARE had an annual budget of $70 million. You know, Sullivan, you know, big resources. TransAfrica wasn't that big financially, not as big as AFRICARE, because AFRICARE was doing development assistance. It got money from USAID and other sources. But CFA has always been small, underfunded, totally underfunded for what we do. And I think and it remains the only one of these organizations that remain. I think it was intentional to eliminate these Black organizations that worked on Africa because they felt that our voices were outsized. In other words, we could shape U.S. policy toward Africa, and they thought that would hurt U.S. trade with Africa and some other stuff. So at the end of the day, they made sure these organizations did not sustain themselves beyond the leader. You know, some of that we should have saw through it and forced ourselves to make sure we have transition.
Speaking of shaping U.S. policy, you do have two major pieces of policy or legislative victory here. Can you talk a little bit about the African Growth and Opportunity Act and the Global AIDS Trust Fund?
When I came to Washington in 84, the U.S. policy toward Africa was largely food relief, you know, starving people in Biafra, so we dropped food out of planes. When you talk about how U.S. was engaged in Africa, it was largely as, feed the hungry. That was it. So several of the African ambassadors and others kind of came and said, we want a different policy toward Africa. We want a policy based on trade and not aid, you know. The primary purpose of the policy should be doing business. There was a black guy who was chief of staff for Congressman Jim McDermott named Mike Williams. And then there was I don't know if you know Rosa Whitaker. Rosa's from Washington. And Rosa now lives in Ghana. But Rosa was then working for Congressman Charlie Rangel. And Mike was with Jim McDermott. And they wrote a piece that they wrote the legislation, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. And they came to me because they wanted to get grassroots support for it. In other words, if we're going to change how the U.S. is looking at Africa, we got to get grassroots support. So I immediately embraced it. Several of the African ambassadors then took the lead. The ambassador of Senegal and ambassador of Uganda were the heads among the African corps. I ended up designing and structuring something like 50 town meetings on Africa around the United States. And I would use African ambassadors and speakers and experts on trade like Mike and Rosa and others. But I did them in places like we did it in Little Rock, Arkansas, when Hillary Clinton was in Uganda, you know. And so we had a town meeting in Little Rock, Arkansas. Well, you know, the whole media, everybody was focused on that because, you know, Americans by and large are uneducated, undereducated, or miseducated about Africa. So here we go holding this meeting at a local, you know, at a local level. And, the first ladies in Africa, you know, so that had a tremendous impact. People wrote letters. They called their member of the Congress. We went to all of the districts where Congressional Black Caucus members were, and we got those members to host the meeting. You know, they were happy to do it. But we brought Africa to the people and encouraged them to support the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. So that's kind of how AGOA got passed. It was a grassroots effort. And CFA played a critical role because we got the grassroots to respond, write their member of the Congress, and say we want support for the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Amazing stuff. That was really when I first started learning how to lobby, you know, and the power of lobby. Now, with Andy Young, Ambassador Andrew Young was my chairman. He was my first chairman of my board. And Andy was, one of the biggest black people you had in the country at the time. He was coming. He was in the process of heading up the Olympics, when he agreed to become the chairman of CFA. And Andy is an absolutely superhuman being. He was followed by David Dinkins, who was then the former mayor of New York. And Dave Dinkins was great, and he also pushed for the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. And he went with me around the country and. We went to South Africa, did all kinds of things in promotion of AGOA. Then my third chair was a Congressman Ron Dellums out of California. And Ron was an absolutely dynamic human being. But after he left Congress, he went to South Africa. This is out in the middle of the AIDS pandemic. He got briefed on it and whatnot. He came back. And his term for taking over the chairmanship of CFA was that we shift our focus from AGOA to HIV/AIDS. And do something about the AIDS pandemic. And George Bush was the president then. So we did a whole lot of things to lobby George Bush to support a global response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. You know, I don't know how old you are, but back then, that was just the most horrifying story. We thought it was going to kill all of us, you know, and because all kinds of people were dying from AIDS, the gays, just all kinds of people were affected and dying from it. And the numbers in Africa were just overwhelming. But, you know, we didn't even know, because again, we don't know what's going on in Africa, but we knew a lot of people were dying. And some of these people were happy about that. You know, let them die, and then we can go and take the minerals, you know? That's what they were thinking. So we were pressing George Bush to launch a U.S. response, and we were pushing for $3 billion for the AIDS pandemic. Bush gets before the microphone at the State of the Union, and where he's laying out his priorities, and he said $19 billion for HIV/AIDS in Africa.
Wow.
$19 billion. It blew us away, you know, because we thought we were asking for something with the $3 billion. Now, today is World AIDS Day, and, you know, a lot of people forgot the role that CFA played, you know, and I don't have really the capacity or the resources to keep people focused, because a lot of the people who were around then, Ron Dellums is dead, you know. Barbara Lee, who took over for Ron, his seat in Oakland, California, but now she is kind of, you know, she's running for Senate, but everything comes out of her mouth, you think she did it. And she was just the bag carrier back then. She was nowhere. Ron Dellums drove that. But that's how we are. Everybody grabs what they want. So we took on the AIDS pandemic, and we got them to do it. And we pressed, you know, we supported them, and we pressed for them to do more things to address the pandemic. Also, Obama, when Obama came to power, you know, Republicans have messed up the economy when Obama came to the White House, just like they do, you know, how they do. Well, you know, they have messed up. The banks start crashing. General Motors was about to crash. You know, the economy was in doomsday mode. And they wanted to welcome to the White House Mr. Black Man. And so Obama sent one of his envoys over to see me. And he said, Obama wants to help Africa. His father is a Kenyan. He wants to help Africa, but he can't do it right now because of the U.S. economy. What do you think he can do in the first year or two to show that he cares about Africa, but don't having to spend a lot of money? You know, we ain't talking about the $3 billion that Bush, you know, the $19 billion that Bush committed. Bush also committed support, $5 billion for the Millennium Challenge account, which was an innovative way to provide financing for African countries. So I wrote a paper for Obama, and I'm looking at it now. I told him, he should plan a White House conference on Africa. And that became the U.S.-Africa summit that took place last December. You know, we were thinking something more modest at the White House, where he would invite all the African leaders to the White House, and we would have a discussion on Africa. I also asked him to make a trip to Africa, which he did. I asked him to engage the next generation of leaders in Africa. I told him, don't spend his time with Mugabe and Biya and Bashir and those old guys. Work on the young next generation coming up in Africa. They loved it. And that became YALI, the Young African Leaders Initiative. I also asked him to set up an African diaspora office in the White House. Well, he gave that to Hillary Clinton, who was the vice president. He gave that to Hillary, and Hillary ended up didn't understand it. So anybody who had a diaspora, she put them in one basket. So if you're from Sri Lanka, you're part of the diaspora. If you're from Jamaica, you're part of the diaspora. She didn't even understand it. And so she ended up creating a mess that nothing happened with it, you know. And so that's what Biden picked up on. And he launched his own committee about a month ago. That was my idea. In fact, I was one of the few people who were invited to the swearing-in. I'm not happy with the implementation of it. Ambassador Carson and others give me full credit for it happening. But you can't tell them how to do it. You can tell them what to do, that they should do this. But then when they decide they're going to do it, that's on them. And so they end up choosing, in my mind, they chose the wrong people. I should have been on it for sure. But I think what they wanted was people who, one, were connected to money, you know, most of them were connected to corporations and that kind of thing. And then they wanted people who are going to be compliant, you know, who are going to say what they want to say. There was a reception 2 nights ago where Denise Laurent, who's a friend of mine, who they made the executive director of the advisory committee, the diaspora advisory committee. Now she's 8 months pregnant, so she's due to give birth next month. So they rushed to have this reception for her. I couldn't go because I was with Ambassador Carson over at Howard. But none of the 12 members were there. How could that be? You know, you chose 12 people to be on this advisory committee, and not one of some of them are from the Washington area. If not, you could have flew a couple of men, you know, just to offer support. But they didn't do it. So I just tell you how weak it is. And Biden was supposed to go to Africa this year. He promised as part of the U.S. summit, but because of the war with Israel and Hamas, he can't travel. You know, he was going to go to the environmental summit in Doha, and then he was going to go to Africa. And so that's been postponed for this year, and it's not going to happen next year because of the elections. So he's not going. So where is the diaspora committee? They're supposed to be out there screaming, you know? Mr. President, either get to spend 10 minutes, you know, stop off and you're going to somewhere else, stop off in Senegal or something for a half hour to fulfill your promise that you went to Africa.
Mr. Foote, as we sort of wind down here, I have two more questions. The first one is, number one, hearing that, you know, you guys requested $3 billion and ended up getting, you know, over six times that amount. How do you go about organizing a policy victory on that level? And we can close out there.
Well, the how question, I made it up as I went along. You know, it's not a book out there to tell you how to do this stuff, but I figured it out. It's almost like playing chess. And what I figured out was, in order to have a voice, you got to put it in writing. You got to put good ideas down there in writing. I've always operated more of a facilitator and a coordinator as opposed to being the expert. I have no real claim to be the expert or anything, but I got access to all the experts. So what I'm able to do was bring the thinkers from the diaspora together. And what we did for this policy paper that we gave to Biden, we had a meeting of 40 people. Some of them were on trade, some of them were on healthcare, some of them were on next generation and so forth. And we ended up having break it out in committees and actually came up with the recommendations, what we put into a very strong policy paper from CFA. And then the question become one, how do you get it implemented? And what we did, the vice president had a director for Africa who was my good friend. In fact, her and her husband, they met in my office. That's how they met. They now they got five sons. She's now the U.S. ambassador to Cote d'Ivoire, right? Wow. So, you know, we met, this was during the COVID years, and she invited me over to their house for dinner. And we talked about this paper. She said, the policy is, you know, we're going to change the policy. The Biden administration is going to have an Africa policy. Give me your recommendations. She gave me a deadline. I pulled my 40 people together, and we crafted that paper with the strong recommendations. And sure enough, it was well written. I had a friend of mine out in L.A. who used to work in city government. He was a Peace Corps volunteer, too, who actually led the writing of it. Excellent job. We used technology. You know, you didn't have to be in one room to do it. Some of us were over here. Some of us were over there. But the paper got well written and it was well received. And then when they Biden announced his Africa policy before the summit, you know, you look at that and compare that to our paper, it's almost like 80%, you know, tit for tat. So I learned how to do that. We did the same thing after the trip with Mali. Within 3 or 4 days, we had our own paper. We had our report with pictures and policy recommendations. We came up with about 10 recommendations for the U.S., you know, to engage in these Sahel countries. And the biggest one was, support people-to-people initiatives. If you don't get along with that country, sure, you got your thinking about coups and all this kind of thing, but your first order of business should be some Americans should go and talk to some people from that country. And some of those people should be like our delegation. We had Malians in the delegation. Malian Americans were part of the delegation. So we go there and we warmly received, you know, we warmly received. Sure, I asked some hard questions about some things. I got opinions, how they think about it. And we compiled it, put it in the report, added our recommendation, and added a bunch of pictures, including the U.S. ambassador in Mali. She hosted us at her home for a reception with Mali entrepreneurs. And so that had a profound impact. I was talking to my colleague today. She said she went to the USAID website and the State Department website, and she couldn't believe how they've already changed their tone toward these Sahel countries and talked about people-to-people diplomacy. That came directly from our paper. So if you want to know how to do it, the how question is, you definitely need to have some advice. And I think I'm an excellent person to give that kind of advice, given the fact that we've done what we've done. But there's other people out there, too. One got to think through it. A lot of times people are scared to deal with the government. You know, they think that if they say something the government don't like, they're going to get blackballed or they're going to have a problem. That is not the case. All of those people over in the government know me. You know, when Ambassador Carson saw me at the Howard the other day, he hugged me, you know. And if you're in the government, you gotta walk the line. And one of the best things I did was decide not to go into government. That was a great decision for me. Because if I was in the government, I would have a hard time because I can't hold my tongue. I don't care if you dislike it or whatever, you got to go along with the policy, period. Johnny is a skilled diplomat, and he's been in the process for, 30 years, 40 years or more. So he knows how to keep his mouth shut. He knows how to walk the line. I don't, you know. But that don't mean we can't be friends. That don't mean I can't give him my recommendations. And so sometimes you can give them recommendations. Yali, even this African Diaspora Committee, that came directly from me. It's in my paper, directly from us. But they don't give me credit for it. They make it sound like Biden came up with the idea. Okay, so if you want to achieve something, sometimes you just gotta let them take the credit. You know, I give Obama credit for Yali, right? But I'm the one who gave him the idea. You know, I don't need the credit, you know? So that's a very important thing because a lot of times we want to take credit for everything. I did it, blah, blah. And if you do that, you won't get the administration to take on your idea. They got to take on the idea and act like they came up with it. They need the political benefit, not me. So from the outside standpoint, you got to be able to do that. You got to be able to allow them the space. All I want them to do is implement the idea. That's all I want. I don't care if they take credit. Let them take credit. Great.
Mr. Melvin Foote of the Constituency of Africa, thank you so much for taking the time today. Do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I look forward to hearing the document. And anything I can do to help you, don't hesitate to contact me.
Yes, sir. Mr. Foote, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day. Would love to do this again soon. And I'm look definitely looking to interface more with the organization.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, sir.